Hi there. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm suffering with a little bit of a summer cold, so you'll have to bear with me as I do this introduction today. I want to let everyone know that there are a couple trigger issues and trigger warnings with this episode. Drug use is discussed, drug abuse is discussed, as well as mental health issues. Now, my guest, Dale Walsh, had an incident happen when he was at Dartmouth in his 20s that changed the course of his life. And honestly, when I heard his story, I kind of understood that not only is Dale the miracle, you know, 50 years later in his recovery and trying to come out on the other side of what happened that day 50 years ago, but also those who took care of him and tended to him. His father, Lawrence Walsh, who was quite a well-known judge at the time, his doctors, his mother, the institutions that stepped forward to make sure that he could live an independent life while also taking care of him and his mental health. Dale is an extraordinary human being because he's unflappable. He has a sense of humor about his mental health diagnosis, and he also takes everything in stride. He's really a remarkable human being, but I'll let him introduce himself. He is a writer and he's a poet, so he does introduce himself at the beginning of this podcast with a poem. And I hope that you enjoy this interview and Dale's miracle stories as much as I did.
They call a judge and I talk to my father and he says, I said, you aren't going to let him put me in the hospital, right? And he says, I've always been straight with you. I said, okay, fine. So then they called the doctor and doctors in Hackensack. So they called the police. The police like put me in a car, said, can you put a siren on? And they say, sure. So they put on the siren, put me in a holding cell.
How do you self-describe? How would you introduce yourself if you had to go to a party or a conference and you had to get up on stage and tell people who you are?
Well, as a poet, I have an archive of 5,000 poems. I've been writing poetry since my college graduation in 1985. And before that, I wrote 6 novels. But we can go into that later. But basically, so what I do is I have an introductory poem that I tell that I recite that basically sums up what happened to me, and then I give a little explanation. And the poem's called Dale Reviewing What Actually Happened, and it goes like this. Hi, I'm God was the joke I made after killer Dartmouth toke of some primo Ivy League smoke, which apparently caused me to croak because in mental hospital I awoke was roomie Gabriel, the main bloke, who did my delusions angelically stroke, even while doctor claimed my brain broke, the moment divine gag I spoke, testifying I was only a bit quack, which clinicians diagnosed a psychotic attack, preventing me from getting sanity back, until I came to Teaneck Hackensack to pursue resident therapy program track, and deal with my evident lack of reason among psychiatric patient pack who never gave me any slack. Under interrogation, the story didn't crack. So that's basically the story. I came up with what I thought was a great joke. You know, high on God, and the punchline being, how can God be 5'8"? You know, so you know, I found it absolutely hilarious, and I was like walking around Dartmouth campus telling everybody my joke and laughing hysterically, and everybody else was starting to look worried. And after 2 days, the campus cops approached me and said, are you Dale? And I said, yes. And they said, would you come with us? I said, sure. I was actually lighting a bowl of hash when they asked me. So I put the hash in my pocket and went to the police campus cop station wagon cruiser. And instead of taking me to the president, as I expected, of the university, as I expected, they took me to the infirmary where I was interrogated for the next 4 hours by three sets of Ivy League psychiatrists. And 2 days later, I was in a hospital with a roommate named Gabriel in New York City for 13 weeks. And that led to 5.5 years in a private psychiatric program under the direction of one doctor for troubled adolescents and young adults. Basically, it was for rich kids who their parents didn't know what to do with them. So basically, I was in there for 5 years. I got out of there, got my own apartment. I've been living in the same apartment for 44 years. Unsupervised, totally independently, went back to college at Fairleigh Dickinson, graduated magna cum laude in English, started an entrepreneurial career as a tutor. I would help Fairleigh Dickinson people write papers, and I did that for 10 semesters, and I also was on disability, so I was on a minimum of disability. So the income, the income was really what I was doing it for. But that was very successful. And then for a while, I just took off some time and became a degenerate, drinking beer and smoking pot and enjoying life and everything. But all this time, it was building toward my recovery, And so. My mother died in 2012. One thing I should say is in 2007, I went cold turkey. Well, I gave up cigarettes cold turkey in 2000. But in 2007, after a visit home from my mother's birthday, I went up to the bar fully intending to have my first beer in a week. And I had some marijuana. So I was ready for that, too. And I got to the bar and I said, you know what? My mother hates not only does she hate my partying, she blames my whole mental illness on my partying. So I just made a secret vow then and there to give up everything and just ordered a Coke. And I would go back to the bar and I'd drink cranberry and club, but haven't touched alcohol since then. And, I say straight, sane, and sober, and straight means without marijuana, sober means without alcohol. Straight means taking my medication. Sane is taking my medication. So straight, sane, and sober since 2007.
I'd love to just ask you this question because you're a poet and then you said you wrote 6 books. Did you know when you were a kid, did you just know you were going to be a writer?
I decided on my 10th birthday.
Really?
Yeah, I decided on my 10th birthday I was going to be a writer. And, one of the great ironies of my mental illness is it gave me the freedom to become the writer I wanted to become, because basically it freed me from the rat race. My family was always very supportive, not only emotionally, but also, I cost a lot of money and they would always pay. So, they would give me an allowance and everything, but basically I was out of the rat race. So I devoted myself to my writing. And instead of having, even when I got out of the program, they paid for my apartment and everything. So I was I've been very blessed and fortunate in financial ways, just that I've never had to worry about making money to support myself, and this freed me from my writing.
Yeah, I am intrigued by this decision at age 10 to become a writer. Did you just read a book that absolutely captivated you, or did something happen when you were 10 that kind of...
It was just like an eyedropper from God.
It's amazing. That is amazing. Okay, so when you made that decision, were you a little nervous or scared, or were you excited?
I was excited. I can't remember the exact moment, but I remember it was on my 10th birthday, and I just said, I'm going to be a writer. And, you know, and as I got more educated, I thought about being a diplomat, or, you know, my great dream was to be a New York Yankee. That was my greatest dream, was to be a New York Yankee. But unfortunately, I was ball shy. So, you know, my baseball career never really got going, you know, because I'd be playing catch and like I'd miss a ball and it hit me in the face or something. And, you know, I just got ball shy. So, you know, that's where I do my Yankee career, but I'm still a New York Yankee lifelong fan. But when I just decided on my 10th birthday, I was going to be a writer.
I wanted to ask you, I am a fellow writer as well, and I'm a big reader. So I love asking fellow writers this question. What is your favorite thing to read?
Myself. To tell you the truth, you know, I turned 70 in May, and basically, whether it's like the progression of my condition or whatever, I really like lack the concentration to really like focus on a book and everything. You know, in the past, there were like a couple of like esoteric things that really influenced not only my writing, but also my way of thinking and everything. One was Carlos Castaneda. I'm sure you know him.
Yeah.
I read his first five or six books before he just went off and, you know, he ended La La Land. And then my Catch 22 was also like a very big influence. That's one of the most brilliant books I think ever written. It's just like that World War II balance between absolute terror and horror, and the terribleness of war, and the humor that he puts in that book is just like, you know, masterful. And then recently I've just been getting into more like higher awareness books, you know, like higher consciousness books. There's this young lady I follow named Gabriella Kovalenko, who just wrote a book called Falling Up, and I'm in her group, and she is truly a wise person. And, you know, despite her age at 24, I call her the mystic prodigy, you know, because she has finished a book called Falling Up, and I would recommend that. But then I read the Bible a lot. You know, I've been getting back into the kingdom. Not into religion. I am basically out of religion, but I'm into the kingdom or the realm, what I call the realm.
Oh my gosh, you're so perfect, because that is the second question I ask everybody. It's did you grow up in a religious household, and what did that look like for you as a kid growing up?
Well, my mother had three husbands, and my second father, we would go to church every Sunday and go to Sunday school and everything. And then we go to the country club for lunch and that would be our ritual. So I wouldn't say that, you know, I wouldn't say we were a religious household, but my mother's belief in God was absolute. You know, I mean, she didn't attend church, but she was probably like one of the most, you know, like, pious women I've ever known. And I'm not saying that she was weak or anything. You know, my best friend once called her a force of nature. But, you know, she just like had like this incredibly secure and deep trust in God. And I, you know, and for instance, just to give an example, my little sister was born with two holes in her heart. And, you know, and this is the type of story that, you know, she convinced her psychiatrist to believe in God but I think the story is basically my sister was born with two holes in the heart. So they were preparing her for surgery and the holes just like closed, you know, and my mother said that was God, you know, so. And that gets into miracles, magic, to, you know, that's another thing. The whole, you know, people used to ask me, why God, Dale? Why do you think you're God? You know, and basically first off, he's top dog. But, you know, he's a top dog. And secondly, you know, it is like, if you want to model somebody, why not model, you know, the best and everything? So since I got taken away from Dartmouth, since I got sick, I've gone through many religious phases. And actually, the last one is ending now. In 2004, I started going back to the church next door because this person who basically, I prayed to get out of my life, got out of my life. So I went to the church for one time to thank Jesus for getting him out of my life. And basically, for the last 21 years, I've been going every Sunday to that church. But recently, I've run across this guy named Pedro Adeo, who talks about the kingdom, you know, and the kingdom of Jesus. And he's just like expanded my. And he I won't say he's anti-religious, but he's like very skeptical of religion, you know, and how religion has manipulated and turned the word of God against its true principles. So, you know, basically, I'm in a period of I'm not going to church, I'm not being religious, but every day my inner knowing and my inner desire to expand the kingdom and to be a servant of the Lord is growing.
Oh, that's wonderful. It sounds like, I mean, obviously your mother had a great devotion to God, and yeah, talk about a miracle with your sister and the holes in her heart. And then those holes being gone suddenly, she has every right. And it's like, I think that's a perfect reason to be devoted to God, but what an interesting journey for you. And as you said, it's still evolving. It's still changing because you just seem so inquisitive and curious about the world. And I'm sure that served you in good stead. Absolutely. I wanted to just go back. I loved your poem. I thought it was hilarious, but also clever and wonderful. And, you know, I am sure on that day, when you had your, you know, encounter with schizophrenia for the first time, you're so young, you know, you're in college, you're at Dartmouth. Nobody plans for anything like that to happen.
Right.
Yeah. And so were you aware while it was happening, or did you just think it was normal what was happening?
No, I was very aware. You know, this is 1975, and actually, I should preface everything by talking about my Dartmouth career for a little while, because I was very academically successful. I was a freshman doing upper level courses, and I had a B+, A- average. But I was doing, I was seriously a drug addict or drug user, drug abuser, whatever you want to call it. But I was like doing high powered Ivy League marijuana every day, constantly, LSD, mescaline, mushrooms, everything but cocaine. And cocaine only came in at the very end. And, you know, that was never a problem with me. But, you know, marijuana, especially, I just loved it, you know, and LSD too. You know, I never had a bad trip. It could be argued that I'd caused a lot of other people bad trips, but I never had a bad trip. But anyway, so when I got taken away, when the campus cops approached me, it was a week after a fraternity had an electric Kool-Aid acid test. I don't know if you know what that is. Okay, well, that's a famous book by this guy named Thomas Wolfe about Ken Kesey. You know Ken Kesey, the author of Whoever Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? Well, Ken Kesey was one of the first person ever to have access to LSD because he was in some sort of experiment at Stanford University in the 50s and late 50s, early 60s. So basically, he found out about LSD before anybody else knew about it. And he started this group called the Merry Pranksters, who were all like doing LSD and everything. So what they would do is they would have what they would call electric Kool-Aid acid tests, where they would like go out into the public just to see how people reacted. And they would like, you know, drink the Kool-Aid. They put LSD in the Kool-Aid and then they pass it out and see how people reacted and everything. So anyway, a week before I got taken away from Dartmouth, and their philosophy was go with the flow. You know, that was the whole philosophy of LSD. So when the campus cops approached me, I said, sure. You know, they didn't even hassle me about the hash I was lighting or anything. And actually, I finished that hash later in the infirmary. But the point is that I was going with the flow. So, you know, I was ready for it. You know, I figured I was exploring new territory with this high on God thing. So I was just curious to see where it would take me. So I got, you know, long story short, I got a transport to my parents' apartment. And the next day they took me to this fancy office in this very nice building on the campus of New York Hospital. And I met a doctor named Dr. Cohane, who I call Cocaine Cohane. And we're having a very nice talk. My parents are there, my mother and father, and we're having a very nice talk. And he says, would you sign this? And I look at my mother and she says, sign it. So I signed it and said, okay, fine. Interview over. So my parents got up. I got up. Dr. Cocaine Cohane got up. My parents went left. I went left to follow them. And Dr. Cohane says, no, Dale, you come with me. And that began 13 weeks on a locked unit. I could get passes, but basically it was like 13 weeks on a locked unit. And then they had to figure out what to do with me because Dartmouth wouldn't let me back because I'd had a psychiatric extraction. And so I had to wait a year before they would consider taking me back. So I'd worked sewer pipelining in Oklahoma with my living with my grandmother for the previous summers. So I wanted to go down to Oklahoma City and just work sewer pipelining until I could go back to Dartmouth. But my mother's psychiatrist and everybody else had different ideas. And they said I had to be among my peers and, you know, I needed help. You know, I couldn't ignore this and everything. So long story short, I ended up in this program four or five and a half years. They told me I'd be there. I'd be in Hackensack for 6 months and it's been 50 years now.
Wow. Oh my goodness. I can't even imagine that. I think a lot of people, well, most people probably, they have an idea for their life. They think it's going to go in a certain way or a certain direction. Something's going to happen. They're going to be able to follow the path. They can create the life they want. But it sounds like yours, you know, at Dartmouth went in a direction nobody had planned for. And I want to just say I'm grateful for the support that you had, for your parents, for people just...
Doctors,
for people stepping up and taking care of you. I can't even imagine what you have gone through. And I mean, right now would be a good place to ask the main question, because I think it ties in really beautifully with what we're talking about and what you're referencing and telling about your life, which is, I would so appreciate if you would tell a story of something magical or miraculous that happened. And to be honest, talking with you here and having this conversation, all I'm thinking is that you are the miracle, quite honestly.
I appreciate that. And to be honest, it's a miracle. I've survived 50 years of diagnosis. So that you know, to me, that's affirmation that I might not be God, but I've been working with God, you know. So, and probably the most magical story I have is my three night, 4 day walk through New York City under the influence of baby rosewood seeds, which is a natural hallucinogenic from Hawaii that was legal for a while and is the best drug in the world. Officially it's an hallucinogenic, but basically I walked through New York City for 3 nights and 4 days by myself. So basically I was in Central Park for two days, just walking around the same area and everything. And during the night, I would run into nobody, and I would just, and I came up with like great ideas, like a female Dale. You know, I'd say, where is female Dale? And actually I met her like 2 months later, but I was in Central Park for 3 nights, and then I went down to the courthouse area with my friend from boarding school. She brought me down. And so I spent the whole day, walking around the judgment, the courthouse area, ran into like two people that I hadn't seen in like 15 years and everything. And then I crossed the Brooklyn Bridge. I left my shoes at the Museum of Natural History because I figured they might want them as a display. So anyway, I was crossing the Brooklyn Bridge, and I threw my shirt off to start the Brooklyn 500 car race off the bridge. And so I get to this like integration center on the other side of the Brooklyn Bridge. And it's like I walk up, and you know, there's a door, and there are people around the door. So I'm just like standing there, and this guy comes out and says, you know, sort of like pushing me away from the door, pushing me back from the door. And I said, "Who are you?" And he says, "Double Dale." So okay, so basically, you know, he goes in, and it's like some sort of like educational center, school or something, or you know, but. Anyway, so I say, "You gotta get in touch with the judge." So I say, "Okay." And the judge is my father, Judge Walsh. So they get in touch with them. And I'm having a great time meanwhile. I mean, this is fun. So, you know, so they call a judge, and I talk to my father, and he says, I said, "You aren't going to let him put me in the hospital, right?" And he says, "I've always been straight with you." I said, "Okay, fine." So then they called the doctor and doctors in Hackensack. So they called the police. The police like put me in a car, said, "Can you put a siren on?" And they say, "Sure." So they put on the siren, put me in a holding cell for probably an hour until Doc comes, and you know, in a suit and looking very official and everything, bails me out. I have no shoes. I have no shirt. I just got my pants on. And so first thing in the car, Doc goes, You're toxic, man. You're going to the hospital. I say, okay, well, you know. So I guess the judge felt that I needed the hospital too. But, and so like, I'm like having all these scenarios in my head, like as Doc is driving me to back to Hackensack about Doc and my parents having dinner to like discuss the crisis and everything. And so anyway, I get to the hospital. It was like the best hospital stay I ever had. I've been in the hospital 15 times actually. And one thing I say with pride is I was hospitalized 15 times and I was discharged 15 times. So every time they ultimately had to say I was sane. So my baby Rosewood Seed Walk in 1978 was really a turning point. That's probably the most magical story I have.
Well, I want to ask you, now you keep referencing this 50-year span of time. And I mean, quite honestly, I don't think your parents, your doctors, or even you could imagine that this 50 years would elapse and happen and that you'd have this 50-year journey, quite honestly, through schizophrenia. I mean, how did you navigate it in the earlier days?
Being in the program was basically the key. Because not only did I have the doctor and the doctor and I had a lot of disagreements. We had like lifestyle view differences, perspectives and everything. But he did keep me in line. He did give me a home when nobody else would. And basically with three individual and two group sessions a week, I was just like immersed in therapy. And therefore, it was like, you know, that's how I got to the point where I could be by myself for 44 years living independently. But, you know, it was a lot of work, obviously. And, you know, people talk about end of work and out of work and everything. And, you know, it's just like part of my DNA now, you know, is it? And so. But in answer to your question, it was really like being in the program. And actually, I was hospitalized 9 times when I was in the program. I've been hospitalized a total of 15 times. The last 5-6 times I was hospitalized, I admitted myself because I knew I was psychotic. And that's part of the recovery journey, but that's also part of the self-awareness that I, you know, advocate. And we didn't mention this yet, but actually I do have a mentoring situation for the family caregivers of those with schizophrenia. It's a program that basically was gifted to me by God. It's called the Live Love Program. And Live Love is an anagram that stands for learn, integrate, validate, explore, and then listen, observe, value, and express. And I have like a 9 and then like a final session, you know, to summarize and everything. So I have like 9 sessions over 3 months on Zoom, one-on-one, and for an hour. And we deal with the challenges and the heartaches, not only of being a caregiver for someone with schizophrenia, but also what I really want to emphasize in my work is breaking the codependency and the helplessness and the victimhood of the mentors, of the caregivers, you know, so that they can grow themselves and continue their own growth while becoming better caregivers for their loved ones.
Yeah, I was just listening to you and thinking to myself, I mean, one of the other miraculous items about your life and your story is the amazing amount of love and support you've received from, it seems like, a lot of different people. And I mean, none of us can go through this life without support and love from other human beings and feeling like we belong, feeling like there's a place for us. And quite honestly, it just sounds like your family and your doctors, they just showed up over and over and over again for you. But also you showed up, right? Because you showed up for your programs and to learn. And it's astonishing that, you know, you recognize that you were becoming psychotic. So you checked yourself into the hospital yourself. And, you know, a lot of other people would have had the life that you did, and they might be really sour now or bitter or angry, but you're not. You have this really resilient, playful, creative spirit. And I think that's another miraculous thing. I mean, I really do think your spirit and your sense of joy and creativity has gotten you through. Would you agree?
Definitely. Well, actually, my doctor called until I found out I was a paranoid schizophrenic schizoaffective when I applied for disability. He always said I suffered from psychotic bliss.
I've never heard of that.
Well, it's purely for me. Yeah, but that's his term that he came up with. And when I was here's another psychiatric term you might have never heard that they came up with for me, which is in my first hospital, my doctor said I was suffering from infantile omnipotence complex.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. You know, speaking of that, I think a lot of people, when they hear about schizophrenia or they read a story about schizophrenia, you know, the sufferer, the person who's schizophrenic, really, there seems to be this common theme of thinking that they're God. And you have sort of alluded to the fact that you stopped believing that within the last few years. So how did that happen?
In the last few weeks. Actually.
Last few weeks. Okay. So how did that happen?
Well, I think I told you that my journey began on a lunar eclipse, May 25th, 1975, right?
Yes.
And basically it ended on my birthday, May 25th, midnight, May 24th, 2025. So that's 50 years.
Yeah.
And basically that was the 50 years I, as Dale, was trying to prove that I was God, which is why I have 5,000 poems, 6 novels, and all sorts of other things. And I'm in this NAMI group called NR on Voice, where we talk about our mental health journey and everything for people in general. So I was talking to Fairleigh Dickinson. I arranged to have a talk at Fairleigh Dickinson, and I'm talking. And I said, you know, I'm beginning to realize that in my pursuit of God, I've lost Dale. Basically, for 50 years, I've had this glass ceiling of I have to be God to, you know, in order to justify my identity. And as I said, it's a similar situation. It's sort of like there was a giant water balloon above me for 50 years. And somebody finally took a pen and popped a water balloon that's overfilled and just like washed me clean of all my delusions. I finally became the Dale I was before I was taken away from Dartmouth. And that's what we're experiencing now. But this is something that's completely new. You know, I always used to say, you know, I knew Dale 20 years before anybody else did. And so basically I had like an extraordinary youth before Dartmouth, you know, the best boarding school in America and, you know, living in France and England for a year, school year and world I traveled around the world through Asia by myself at the age of 19. So, you know, I just, you know, the Dale before Dartmouth and the enclosure and claustrophobia of the diagnosis is like, was an extraordinary person. And, you know, it's sort of like I'm a little, it's not sad or frustrated or something, but it's just like sort of like I'm trying to understand what I could have already done as Dale if I hadn't gotten caught in this, you know, schizophrenic delusion. But now we can see.
Listening to this episode of the podcast and my conversation with Dale Walsh. I don't think any of us plans to suffer from a mental health crisis, and Dale seems to take it all in stride, but I think that none of us can guess how the last 50 years have truly affected him and the life that he might have lived. And I think it's interesting that Dale is now getting to know himself outside of this belief that he is God. Now he's getting to know the actual Dale. And that's exciting and a miracle in itself. So I want to thank Dale for being so brave and having the strength to show up in the world and let us know about the work that he's doing, not only for himself, but for families who have loved ones that are suffering schizophrenia. If you'd like to know more about Dale and his work in the world, there will be a couple of links in the episode show notes. So dive on in to see the contributions that Dale is making to make this world a more beautiful place for everyone else in it. If you like what you hear, please do consider leaving a rating or writing a little review. Those ratings and reviews help other people find us. Thanks so much for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Dale. Be open, no matter what your age is, to learning who you truly are. I mean, I think life and our inner selves and who we are and how we view the world, how we interact with the world and take it in, our entire lives, it's an evolution. And our minds change day by day. The way we look at the world changes day by day. Every single interaction and meeting and conversation that we have teaches us more about who we are. And so we're kind of on the same journey as Dale, learning who we are day by day, as if each day a fresh us comes into being. And I think that's exciting. It's good to be changeable. It's good to be open to learning new things and learning the capacities we have, the things that we might not know about ourselves. It's fun to be delighted by discovery. So be like Dale and always be open to the search for inner truth about who you are inside and your infinite capacity for change.
There's one thing I always talk about that I think is very important before we leave. It's this concept called agnosognosia, A-N-A-S-O-G-N-O-S-I-A. And it's a term taken from neurology, and it's applied to stroke victims. And it means they can't comprehend that there's something wrong with their brain. So this term has been translated to psychiatry for severe mental illness. And they now estimate that 60 to 70% of people with SMI have agnosognosia. So agnosognosia, to give an analogy, It's sort of like holding a book up to a blind person and saying, read this. So for 60 to 70% of people with severe mental illness to be suffering from agnosognosia, not only, if you were psychotic or even, you know, just having symptoms or something, and someone said, you need medication and you need to talk to somebody, and you were in agnosognosia, you'd say, just an example, no, you're the crazy one. You're the one who needs medication. And so, you know, and if you won't take medication and you won't see a doctor, if you won't get help, then the mental illness is going to deteriorate. So therefore, you know, agnosognosia is like a very serious situation, because not only do people not know it about it, but they also, it also like helps reinforce the stigma against mental illness, because people think that people with mental illness have some sort of control over their illness, and many times they don't.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people take that for granted, you know, who are not suffering mental illness. I think there is a great stigma. Thank you for using that word around mental illness. And I do believe that a lot of people look at someone with mental illness and they think, oh, they can just fix that. They're not trying hard enough. That's not the case.
A classic example, schizophrenia and severe mental illness is even more serious. But, you know, a classic example of that is if you're like clinically depressed, come on, get out of bed, just go get a job and pull yourself up by the bootstrings. You know, there's nothing wrong with you. And, you know, I've fortunately never really suffered depression, but, you know, that's just an example of like the denial, the agnosognosia of the general public to mental illness, and just like how to deal with it. And that really is like a crisis in the world at the moment, because especially with COVID, you know, COVID like highlighted mental illness, because people without the routine that they had built around to give their life meaning found that their life had no meaning, and that leads to mental illness.
Yeah, absolutely. Dale, thank you so much, because this is such an essentially important topic to pay attention to and be aware of. You know, I think very few of us in our daily lives encounter mental illness or people who are suffering from mental illness. And certainly when we're confronted with it or we engage with it, it can be scary and frightening and potentially a little earth shattering. So I think there is a lot of judgment, a lot of stigma in the general public about people who are suffering and they, you know, with mental illness, whether it is depression or schizophrenia, and they just have no idea. I mean, quite honestly, the struggle for those people to get up every day, to show up in the world, to put themselves out in the world. And so thank you so much for highlighting that and bringing that up, because we need to develop more tools, more compassion, more understanding for those who are really just trying to make their way through life with a very, very challenging situation going on inside of them.
One thing that a good friend of mine who I met in the hospital, we fell out of touch, but she said something that I'll never forget. She says, no one realizes the pain of mental illness until you've gone through it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Dale. You are wonderful. And I remember when you sent me that Podmatch message and you said, I think, what did you say? You said, it'll be worth the wait, or our interview will not disappoint, or something like that. And you are 100% right. You speak the truth.
Thank you.